What we're going to talk about tonight is the 1st Vermont Cavalry that was involved in Farnsworth's charge, which was an integral part of the Union action on the 3rd day of July. However, it's always overshadowed by the other action that took place on the 3rd of July, Pickett's charge. And this cavalry charge took place simultaneous with and just after Pickett's charge took place. In fact, the culmination of Farnsworth's charge, which involved 3 regiments in his brigade, the last final push was that of the 1st Vermont Cavalry, and that took place just after Pickett's charge had failed. One way of looking at it is it was the only counterattack that the Union Army made after Pickett's charge. But it started somewhat earlier. During the cannonade, the first elements of Farnsworth's charge occurred, and there are many accounts that were written after the battle, including one by General Meade himself, which said that the action of Kilpatrick's cavalry down here on the south end of the field caused Robert E. Lee to alter his plans for Pickett's charge, and it caused him to lose the support of 2 divisions, Hood's and McLaws. If that's true, then it was a very valuable and worthy undertaking. However, after the battle, and during the 1880s, when the histories were being written of this, written by the veterans, accounts written by the veterans, were scattered few and far between, sometimes in newspapers you can find them, sometimes in diaries and so forth, but the only coherent published account of Farnsworth's charge was written by a man named Henry Parsons. Henry Parsons was the captain of Troop L. Troop is a company. In cavalry, it's company and infantry, it's a troop. And captain of Troop L. And Henry Parsons wrote this account between 1884 and 1887, published it in Century Magazine, and then it was reprinted in Battles and Leaders. Battles and Leaders being a main staple in most Civil War libraries. So everyone has access to the Parsons account. And when I first started doing this course, I interpreted Parsons' account, along with most other modern authors. However, I've gotten to the point now, after a couple years of research, that I don't believe Parsons was entirely accurate. One of the things that I found is a manuscript that he wrote, which indicates that he was not writing purely as an eyewitness, that he was trying to write an overall view of the charge based on his interviews with other people that were involved. Okay, so he tells us himself in his manuscript to the Battles and Leaders account that he was not an eyewitness. However, that disclaimer doesn't appear in the published account, so that when people read that published account, they take it as if he were an eyewitness. Okay? I made the same mistake. I did it for a long time. And but now I have grown suspicious, let's say. And one thing I have to tell you is that if you're going to understand what really happened here, you need to unlearn some of the things, some of the preconceptions that you might have about the people involved in Farnsworth's charge. Okay? How many of you have heard? How many of you heard of the controversy surrounding Farnsworth's charge? Okay? It reads like you might expect a battlefield soap opera to read. Lots of controversies, juicy stuff. Alright, what I want to do first is introduce you to the main characters. And I have to ask you, please, don't come into this with a preconceived notion about any one particular person. And you'll see what I mean. Alright, because most of us rely on published materials. Published materials always have to be looked at with some degree of skepticism, because everyone who writes something has some sort of agenda. And that agenda may not be an historian's agenda just to get at the truth. It might be, you know, something quite different. Okay, now, the key player, the first guy we have to look at is Elon J. Farnsworth. It's all about him, right? Elon Farnsworth was one of the three boy generals. You heard of the three boy generals?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. There's Custer. Okay. Custer, of course, the youngest Union brigadier general here on the battlefield. He's going to get more fame out of his death in 1876 at Little Bighorn than he does all of his Civil War exploits put together. And then there's Wesley Merritt, which I'll talk about in my August class. Wesley Merritt is going to have a military career that spans four decades. Okay? But he's kind of a nobody here at Gettysburg. And a lot of people, you ask about Wesley Merritt, they'll say, oh, was he here? Well, yeah, he was here. Okay? He was one of the boy generals. The third one was Farnsworth. Now, he is sort of the martyr of the story, especially the Battles and Leaders account. The modern interpretation, other authors might be Eric Wittenberg, who wrote a book called Forgotten Cavalry Actions at Gettysburg. He writes about it. Ed Longacre touches on it. And now, another book about it is The Struggle for Little Round Top, the 15th Alabama at Gettysburg by Penny and Lane. That's pretty good. And then also this latest biography of Judson Kilpatrick touches on it some of the other published works. In any case, this boy general, Elon Farnsworth, Farnsworth skipped ranks. He went from being a captain to being a brigadier general. On the 28th of June, one of the first things that Meade does in command of the army is promote these guys. He was not yet 26. He was almost 26 years old, but he's not going to live to see his birthday on July 30th. And he's going to die at Gettysburg. His memory is stained, however, by accusations that he committed suicide. And we're going to talk about that. Okay, lots of stories about suicide. Now, he is painted, especially in this Battles and Leaders account, as the martyr here. How in the world are we going to ever recover from the loss of this young, promising general who could have, you know, done wonderful things? And the fact that he's a martyr is interesting to me because at one point in around 1908, accused of murder by, and this murder allegedly occurred in 1862 while the 8th Illinois, his former regiment, was in Warrenton, Virginia. He was a captain, and allegedly a young boy named Billy Doolin from the 1st Virginia Cavalry, in an exchange there, this boy, his horse was wounded, he was wounded, he fell, his horse fell on top of him, and this 16-year-old boy couldn't get out from under his horse, and the story was that Farnsworth rode up to him, shot him, and killed him dead, this innocent young boy. Okay? The author in 1908 this story. Later, the author would recant the story, but he'd do it in a private letter that wasn't really published, and so nobody ever realized that it really wasn't Elon Farnsworth that committed this murder. It was his Uncle John. Case of mistaken identity. There's more than one Farnsworth in the unit. Well, in 1998, another author recants the story of his murdering. Also, Farnsworth was kicked out of the University of Michigan because he was involved in something that has been referred to as a drinking frolic, an unfortunate affair, all kinds of weird explanations. He got involved in something in which a classmate ends up dead. One account of it, I saw that this classmate was thrown from a college dorm building and was killed. So Farnsworth was kicked out of the university, allegedly part of this act of senseless murder. So, you've got accounts of Farnsworth that say he may not have as much respect for human life as you think. And you also have accounts of Farnsworth by his friends who rode with him that say he was a perfect gentleman, noble, gallant, full of tender regard for his men. So, we don't know which he was. Was he this cold-hearted murderer with no moral ethic? Or was he this noble gentleman? There is cause to question because of these varying accounts. Okay, that's the point I want to make. Whether he committed suicide or not, and we'll talk about that a little bit later, it reflects on his character. Either he was a man who supposedly lived by this code of honor, or it was something that confirmed his alleged wanton disregard for life. It doesn't matter. it still stains his memory. All right, now we get to the villain. Who's the villain?
Judge
Kilpatrick. Yeah. You guys are going to hate me after this. Now, Kilpatrick is interesting. You cannot study Judson Kilpatrick based on what's written in the 1880s. You can't. Because in 1872, Kilpatrick made some really stupid political choices. He elected to be a very active part of a campaign against Ulysses S. Grant. When he was campaigning for re-election in 1872, Kilpatrick chose to be a very vocal part of Horace Greeley's campaign. Horace Greeley was a champion of the Irish. Kilpatrick needed some connection with the Irish. He's Irish. And if you recall, right after Gettysburg during the draft riots, it's Kilpatrick that's sent up there to squelch the draft riots. He gets there too late. He's not even involved. He's put in charge of the cavalry, but nothing really happens after he gets there. Yet the newspapers have it filled with tabloid cartoons of Kilpatrick, this cavalry man, riding on the back of an Irishman, you know, and all kinds of horrible things with Kilpatrick pictured as someone who was whipping the Irish, you know. This was really bad for his Irish image. Anyway, in any case, he decides to campaign for Horace Greeley. He loses a lot of his military buddies, okay? And those are the guys that are here in the 1880s who write the history of what happened. And he's pissed them off, so to speak, okay? Plus, he's dead by 1881. Kilpatrick died in Santiago, Chile in 1881 while still in the service of his country. He was a diplomat, the U.S. minister to Chile. And it might be interesting for you to know that with him, one of his most treasured personal belongings was a sword, a Damascus sword with a silver scabbard given to him by the men who rode with him at Gettysburg. The men under his command in the Gettysburg campaign gave him this sword and scabbard, and I swear it's not a mistake. They say it was worth $6,000 in 1881 when it was appraised. So this is a real, you know, token of the honor and the respect that his men gave him. Now, modern authors would have you believe that his men hated him. They called him Kill Cavalry. All right? I can defy that with numerous firsthand accounts.
Question?
Yes, sir. To first-hand accounts written as close to the time of the war as possible. I'm suggesting that if you get an account from a soldier who rode with him while he's with him, or an account of a soldier not long after the war talking about him, you're going to get more accuracy because it's not inundated with a possible political agenda or some sort of overtones that might affect it. Now, there were men who were very close to Kilpatrick during the war and afterwards who write well into the 1880s trying to give their opinion. These are guys that knew him for 20, 30 years. And these are often ignored when you have an author with a thesis that is Kill Cavalry, slaughtered his own men. He's not going to pull out these accounts of, you know, people who were close to him that would call him a man of honor, because that doesn't fit in the thesis. But I'm not saying that they're wrong, but I'm saying be skeptical of those accounts. I think the truth of Judson Kilpatrick is somewhere in the middle. Okay? I mean, you can't love him and you can't hate him. He's a human being. But most of what's written about him today is more along the lines of an evil monster, as opposed to. Give you some examples, okay? Kilpatrick is described by veterans who rode under him, subordinates, as without a doubt the best cavalry commander in our service. We don't have that, of course, but I'm saying as an extreme, that's one account. The other one is modern interpretations. He's a study in accelerating incompetence. They say that the Army of the Potomac was hurt by the fact that Buford died at the end of 1863, but it was gloriously rejoicing in 1864 when they got rid of Kilpatrick. Anyway, as far as Kilpatrick Patrick's men close to the time of the battle. They say he was always at the front where the battle raged the fiercest, and the men loved him for his personal attention to their wants and for his appreciation for their labors. That's a guy that rode with him in this campaign. More recently, however, he gets described as having a disregard for his men's welfare and vague notions of how best to strike the enemy. The veterans, on the contrary, say no commander in our army did more, when the numbers employed are taken into account, than General Kilpatrick towards suppressing the war against the Union. Yet his latest biographer says he preferred abusing defenseless women and children to confronting his enemy on the field. That's pretty nasty. Okay? P. Rowe, the chaplain of the 2nd New York Cavalry, wrote that Kilpatrick always treated him with kindness. He said, on one of his celebrated raids on Richmond, I rode with him much of the time, and as far as my testimony is worth, it is given emphatically to the truth that he was a brave and most excellent general. On that occasion, he displayed as much caution and consideration for his men as audacity. Seldom did he ever ride past his troops, and they did not lustily cheer him and manifest every possible way their pride and confidence in him. And I need scarcely say that this feeling was mutual and reciprocal. Kilpatrick's pride and confidence in his troops being only excelled by his kindly interest in and regard for their welfare. Now, these are accounts. All I'm saying is, if you are basing your opinion only on what you've read and what's been published after the turn of the century, be careful. Yeah. They're saying in a later account that Kilpatrick was indifferent to the sight of men dying in battle, but he took great delight in seeing the pain and suffering that he inflicted against defenseless Southern women and children. Interesting.
Andy, kind of touch on this later. Obviously, this is from Parsons' account with the argument that takes place up there, and it would appear as if there was a senseless waste of the men in this charge. Yet they seem to be supporting him.
Senseless waste of men in the charge.
When I say that, I mean over the ground that they had the charge, and with the recon, once again, this is Parsons, with the recon that took place, and Farnsworth coming back saying that, it was foolhardy. And
okay, I have what I believe occurred during the argument, and I will touch on it more later, but okay. What I'm thinking is that a recon took place from their position behind or south of Bushman Hill, which is this hill right over here, to the right of Big Round Top. I believe a recon took place, and it was a reconnoiter to find the Confederate right, which was, Law's division on House Ridge and halfway up Big Round Top. They found the Confederate infantry up there, and I think if you go from where they were to that position where Oates was, it is completely strewn with boulders and unable to ride. I don't think Kilpatrick wanted to do that. I think they came back from that recon. It was Company M of the 1st Vermont Cavalry, and I think they told him it was a no-go, and he agreed. That's why I think that this Confederate battery of 10 guns that was sitting up here on this ridge with completely open surround was the target of the Confederate infantry up on the hill. And there are repeated accounts that Farnsworth was charging the battery. He was charging the battery. You don't get that he was charging the infantry. If you read closely, you don't get that until Parsons and a little bit later. But I think that there's also some evidence that Parsons may have a reason to blame this on Kilpatrick. And I'll talk about that later. I think I have a handle on Parsons. Okay? Anybody else? And I don't want to belabor this subject, but, okay? Try to have an open mind, even about Kilpatrick, while you study this. Rich, let me have those pictures. Farnsworth. Everybody seen him? Has everyone seen him? This is dark hair, a dark mustache. He was described by a college professor who had him at the University of Michigan as a tall, black, bearded man. Doesn't have it was while he had, looks like he has a brigadier general uniform on, could have been taken at Frederick right after. like John Wilkes Booth.
Oh.
And every other Union monument on the battlefield. I think he posed. That's Henry Parsons. Okay?
And this Parsons is not the one at Wittenberg.
Wittenberg has a picture of Henry Parsons in his book. It's not the Henry Parsons that was in the First Vermont. I've seen that picture. It's up at Carlisle, but he didn't read it closely enough. It's an infantry name. Same name, different middle initial.
But he intended to be the cavalry.
He wanted it to be the cavalry guy because that's what he was writing about, and he insinuates that it is. But no. Okay.
There's a lot of stuff there.
Yeah, yeah.
Have you seen the Civil War News this time in the book review? Wittenberg's got a good review in there.
It's Kilpatrick at Hunterstown in Hanover. He's absolutely right about that, yeah. I'm not saying his whole work is trash. I'm not suggesting that. I'm saying he's got a picture wrong, and that's a fact. Okay. Now, he also has a picture of, on the very same page, he's got four pictures on one page, three of them are wrong. One of them says Horace K. Ide, Sergeant. It's actually the colonel of the regiment. That's Addison Preston. Colonel here. The man who was really in charge of the regiment is, he's a lieutenant colonel. The colonel is Edward Sawyer. He's not here. He's on sick leave. Okay, so the guy leading the regiment is Addison Preston. If you look in Wittenberg's book, that picture is marked Sergeant Horace K.I., which is clearly. Okay. I'm not doing this to denigrate Wittenberg. I'm just saying if you have the book, you'll know. You guys know who that is. That is
Vander.
Van the Man, the best looking man in the Confederate Army. Okay. He is in charge of the infantry that the Vermont Cavalry will charge against. And the man who is not Chamberlain on this picture is William Oates of the 15th Alabama. We'll talk a lot about Oates and his accounts. Okay? Now, here's a picture of the terrain. Now, you have to, I'm going to pass this one around so you can study it very closely. Circle around where the Alabama Monument is today. But notice, what I want you to notice is this is taken from the Big Round Top Observatory looking back to where we are. Okay, so if you look that way toward Big Round Top, you're looking across the same terrain, and notice the difference.
So that was taken late 1800s, early 1900s, or?
1890s. 1890s? Late 1890s. Since you conveniently like to come to the park. Yeah. We talked about the martyr, we talked about the villain, and part of this is the manuscript that I have this all written, you know, to get it from a magazine, and hopefully write it. Now, some other, definitely want to talk about Parsons. Let's talk about Parsons, okay? Henry Parsons is this guy who wrote the Battles and Leaders account, captain of Troop L, and here is the statement that he writes. When I was requested to reply to published statements, I only undertook to give evidence of my own knowledge. But after consultation with surviving officers, I have decided to attempt a general description of the charge and of the movements that preceded it. At the same time, carrying out my promise to give with minute details the occurrences that I saw. Okay? The disclaimer does not appear in his narrative. And he doesn't differentiate for us what he saw and what he didn't see. That's the only issue. What you have, and he also wrote another account in 1890 that was published. And there are three accounts that Parsons writes, only one of which is published and distributed. But these three have to be compared with each other, and then they have to be compared with other people's accounts to get credibility. One of those other accounts is written by a man named Lieutenant Stephen Clark. He is in command of Troop F of the 1st Vermont Cavalry. And he emphatically asserts, now, this is very, very interesting to me. He emphatically asserts that Parsons did not coherently participate in the charge at all. He asserts that Parsons was wounded before the charge ever started. And I'm here to tell you it was a serious wound. It kept him out of the fight for the next 6 months. He was shot just under the right breast, and it went back and out his back, and it caused paralysis of his right side and his right arm. And he was left on the battlefield until the 5th of July. He was taken to the courthouse in town. Then he was moved to the Stahlsmith House. Then he was moved to the General Hospital on July 15th. He finally started his trek back to Vermont, and he had to be physically carried. was badly hurt. Now, his own account would have you believe that that happened at the end of the charge. Farnsworth was killed at the end of the charge. Other men around Farnsworth were killed after the charge, on their way back to the Union lines. Parsons would have you believe that also happened to him, but here's a man that says, I saw Parsons when he went down. Okay, Stephen Clark says that the 1st Vermont was still in column of fours, back behind the hill, before the charge ever started. He says, he said that his company, Company F, or Troop F, Clark's troop, was the third one in the line, in column of fours. And he says, I did not hear the instructions given to the commander of the battalion, that would be Parsons, who was the captain of Company L, before this charge started. The captain's horse was shot and himself badly wounded before the charge started. Two leading companies were badly cut up and did not go further in the charge. As my front became open to the fire of the enemy, I gave the order forward, and down the road we went in column of fours. So Parsons was already wounded before the charge ever started, so he didn't see too much. That would be Clark's account. The other thing is that when the regimental history is written, the 1st Vermont Cavalry's regimental history is written by G.G. Benedict, who was not a member of the 1st Vermont Cavalry, but it was written in conjunction with all the other Vermont units, and so he was a Vermont infantryman, and he wrote, using Parsons' account, the story of what happened here. After that story's published, after the regimental history comes out, Clark believes he better restate his position, because it doesn't appear that way in the regimental history. He says, history says Captain Parsons and the other officers fell about the same time and place, dangerously wounded. Now, I saw Parsons fall, he said. Saw the men near him, and in my immediate front, in column of fours, melt away before the deadly fire in front, and we were the third company in column. That's not the way the charge took place. That is before the charge, okay? So here we have reason already to question whether or not Parsons was in the charge. And when we get a little bit further in the class, we're going to go down and look at the William Wells Monument, and you notice there's a bronze bas-relief sculpture of the charge taking place. Henry Parsons is pictured on that sculpture, still in his saddle, but riding in the charge like this, slumped over his horse with his head face down. And I'm saying it is possible, perhaps, that he was wounded before the charge took place, and that his horse carried him through the entire charge. Because his horse was also wounded, and, you know, in the heat of the moment, his horse could have just, you know, gone along with the other horses. My horse would do that. You know? You're in a charge, you just do what's natural. And he was used to riding with the other horses, and if Parsons isn't strong enough to hold him back, that horse could very easily have carried him through the entire charge. But if he was wounded first, he didn't see much. Another Vermont officer who was in the charge was asked by Parsons to give his account of what happened during the charge, and he said, I didn't see anything. He said, if you rode in a cyclone, what would you see? So he's saying that there's so much confusion swirling around him that there isn't much that he can offer. Okay. One more thing about the Parsons. He says that he was assisted in his accounts by E.A. Paul, which was a correspondent that rode with Kilpatrick's headquarters, and by John Batchelder and his guides to write his account. Well, that might lend credibility to it. However, John Batchelder's map is different from Parsons' map. And E.A. Paul's account, which was published July 10th and again on July 23rd, 1863, is different from Parsons'. So that makes us wonder a little bit. The other thing is, I told you on the July 15th, Parsons goes back to Vermont. Okay? He stays in Vermont, recovering from this horrible wound until January of 1864. In January, he starts back. The governor of Vermont asked him to take some new recruits along with him down to Washington. Gets to Washington, is very sick. The journey must have been rigorous. He's still very sick. He gets a fever. He gets admitted to the hospital. Finally, a couple weeks later, he gets out of the hospital. He finds his regiment in Stevensburg, Virginia. He shows up. He had just written a letter that said, I'm stronger than ever, anxious to come back. Shows up in camp, and they tell him, sorry, bud, you have been dismissed from the Army. Here. Henry Parsons, after making that trek from Vermont, found out that he was already mustered out of the Army. Discharged. For wounds received at Gettysburg, his discharge was backdated until January 4th, 1864, before he ever left Vermont. It was a surprise to Henry Parsons, I'll guarantee you, because I've got a letter he wrote after that, and he never knew it. He wouldn't have made that journey if he'd known it. But I have a hunch that he might have some resentment toward somebody. And maybe, just maybe, he has a resentment toward the assholes of his regiments that had not been in touch with the regiment that was AWOL, so to speak, was to be formally discharged from the Army so they could get new recruits to put in their place. We're not just going to carry around 100 names if they're not here doing duty. Get them off the rolls. And Parsons got caught up in that. Okay, he just didn't know it. After the war, Henry Parsons comes back to Gettysburg. Remember, this is the last battle he ever fought. So this is the one that he's going to write about. He comes back to Gettysburg. Although he owns property in Natural Bridge, Virginia, he comes to Gettysburg and he buys the Slider Farm, 55 acres, encompassing much of the area where the First Vermont rode during the charge. He buys the farm. He didn't buy the farm, but he bought the Slider Farm in 1888. Doesn't ever record the deed. This I find interesting. The deed is not recorded. In 1890, two Vermont monuments went up on the property. Now, he might have bought the property just so that Vermont could use it for their monuments. The Sharpshooters Monument down by the Slider Lane and the First Vermont Cavalry Monument up in the meadow. Okay? In 1895, he sells it to a man, McPherson, who within a month turns around and sells it to the national government. He kept the property from 1895. During that time, he became an expert, right? That he walked the grounds, that he drew his map based on his own personal research. But I don't know if he ever came here to visit very often, but his account in Battles and Leaders was written before he owned the property. It was done and in print by 1887. That he owned the property, I thought, man, we gotta believe him. He lived here. He walked the ground, you know, he knew. Anyway, those are the key characters. Any questions about these guys? Is it at least enough to make you question? This is Carol Reardon. She said, as historians, we have an obligation to be objective chroniclers of the past, and that our readers have an obligation to be skeptical, cynical, and keep us on our toes. I think that is an excellent way to put it. So be skeptical of anything you read, and if they have footnotes, go read them. Pull the documentation. If you're interested in a subject, find out if it's true. A lot of times the documentation doesn't support the fact. You have to be able to have it in your hand and look for any questions. No questions about
that Paul map that was done July 23rd.
It's not a map, it's a account. It's an account.
Oh, it's an account.
Yeah.
Was that, where'd you find that? Is it?
It's either in the, I think it's in the New York Times. New York Times or the Tribune. I think it's the Times. And I have a copy of it in my folder. And it's a very accurate and vivid account of what happened. E.A. Paul was assigned to the cavalry and he was assigned, I'm sure, to Pleasanton's headquarters. But at one point, when he's employed with the Times, he says, look, you know what? I'm going with Kilpatrick. Oh, it was Julius Stahl before Kilpatrick took over. And he said, I'm going with Kilpatrick's division. I'm not staying with my assignment. You want to fire me? Fine. But this is where the action's going to be. So he stays with Kilpatrick. He stays with him throughout the whole war, writes of all those accounts, and then later he's around in the 1870s when Kilpatrick goes for his pension as an eyewitness to his medical condition, etc. Kilpatrick had a bad medical condition. He had kidney problems. It finally kills him in 1881, but during the Civil War, you find him a lot of times stretched out on his back, laying in his tent, or in a wagon, or in a carriage or something because of the back pain. And surgeons say that he would never let them treat it, and that might be the problem why, you know, it finally killed. A Paul account, I can get you a copy if you want it. It's available.
That counters Parsons, obviously.
So do others.
Uh-huh.
Others. PA Paul because he's an eyewitness and he's stationary. Another thing I like is, okay, let's just forget about everybody that rode in the charge. Let's say all they saw was the cyclone. Let's say they saw what was in front of them and that was it. Well, up on Big Round Top, you have Fisher's men. The reserves are up there. During the charge, they write about it. They tell us the route of the charge. Okay? They cheer them. So they're like in the bleachers, as far as I'm concerned. I like those accounts. I like the surgeons' accounts, because what do they do during the fight? Wait and see who gets wounded. So they're standing up there near the headquarters on Bushman Hill, looking out over. So they tell us some things.
Are Fisher's accounts in Pennsylvania, Gettysburg, or are they in regimentals?
They're in regimentals and in diaries. Most of what I got from Fisher is in the Park Library under, you know, the 5th PA Reserves, in their folders, regimental folders. So you have those accounts, and I like those stationary accounts. Mm-hmm. Also, I like General Law. What's General Law doing if not watching the action? Right? That's his job. So when, and Law's headquarters, by the way, is in the picnic area back here.
Mm.
For obvious reasons, he had tables, you know.
In the bathroom and that.
Bathroom was close by. I don't blame him. His headquarters was right back here. Now let's go across the stream and talk about the deployment of the guns and the path of the charge. Wright Avenue and Howe Avenue and those monuments, those are all Vermonters, you know. Albion Howe and his Lou Grant's brigade, they're here. The old Vermont brigade. Well, they were stationed behind Big Round Top, it's true, and they were from the peak, the highest peak they could see, down to the road and across the road, their skirmish line. And they say that on the morning of July 3rd, their skirmish line went out further to the south and then extended to the right. They went out and got involved in that, got attached to the cavalry. When you read accounts in Wittenberg's book, I know he talks about this, how after the charge, they go back through the Vermonters. And Wittenberg's judging by where the monument is between the Round Top, Little Round Top, Big Round Top, and he says Farnsworth must have gone out between the hills. No. The Vermonters that say they saw him was the 4th Vermont under Staunton, who were the skirmishers who were down south and moving around this way. So it all falls together when you look at the account. When Farnsworth was through with the charge, he went right between Big Round Top and Bushman Hill to try to get back to his line. That's why some of his men went right through the Vermont skirmish line.
Is Kathy Harrison, have you talked to her at all? I mean, I know she redrew Parsons' map a little bit. And
I use that. I've never talked to Kathy, but I've never found any real blatant errors with Kathy's stuff either, but she uses Parsons exclusively. So I don't know. I also think that it's possible that some of these other accounts have just never surfaced.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, you know, going back and sitting at the microfilm readers and just, you know, constantly, night after night, just trying to, oh my gosh, one little mention, and, you know, you might find two or three sentences that hook it together. I think it's just a matter of research that continues. It's always going to. And a year from now, another person might do this class and have something I didn't have. And I think that's very legitimate. Okay. Edwards Brigade is assigned to Kilpatrick's division, as is Custer's Brigade. Received orders, and this is when his division is massed down at two taverns down the Baltimore Pike. Received orders to move to the left of the Union line, and you know the fishhook ending down here. Move to the left, he's coming from behind, of the Union line and make an attack against the Confederates over here. And in a lot of accounts, the men believe that there was a Confederate offensive trying to outflank them on the left. John Buford's division. He had three brigades, but only Devin and Gamble were with him on day one. Merritt was the 3rd brigade. He's in Emmitsburg. He comes up early on the morning of July 3rd, and he's told to join up with Kilpatrick, meet him. And as he comes up the Emmitsburg Road, General Law is standing out here, and he realizes, he gets some reports from his skirmishers, infantry regiments out, and go down and face that way. The 2nd Main Infantry Line is on Hawks Ridge, right at the base of Little Round Top. You can see Little Round Top up there. At the base of it is Law's division now, because he took over for Hood, he was wounded. And it extends onto Big Round Top, about halfway up. There's a stone wall, and at the very far right is Oates, Colonel William Oates, in 15th Alabama. And they're up there. Now, Law moves the first Texas out of line down at the base of Little Round Top, pulls them out, and they come down here and start lining up. You see where they cross the street, just behind the Soldiers and Sailors Monument, behind the hill, and of course the Round Top. They line up along that stone wall. The concentration of the regiment, the first Texas, is down over the hill, but most of the regiment is strung out from here to front. There was like one man every 15 paces, like a long skirmish line, one line. Now they do have some companies of skirmishers. Texas goes over in the at night, as Merritt comes up and starts his fight, Law will pull out the 9th Georgia of Anderson's brigade, send them down there. A little bit later, he pulls the 7th and 8th Georgia, sends them down there, they start moving. And I think the Vermonters, who are behind this tree line, now it's open terrain south of Richmond Hill. And he puts all these infantry regiments down there. Here's a thin spot. And the thin spot is right in here. This is where Kilpatrick is going to take advantage of that thin infantry position to hit the 1st Texas. As far as the men in Farnsworth Brigade, units, there are 600 men in 1st Vermont that are going to be engaged. 600 men. Out of those 600, 13 killed, 25 wounded, 27 missing, total of 65. The percentage. People thinking it's a slaughter. As far as other Kirsten, 7th Michigan, topped them out. The 7th Michigan was at the top with 26%, and the 1st Michigan, 17%. Still count Kilpatrick. He wasn't even there and he gets blamed for that. But anyway, okay, 10.8. Then as far as the other regiments in Farnsworth Brigade, you have the 1st West Virginia, and you have the 18th Pennsylvania, and the 5th New York. Now they come to the battlefield. The 1st Vermont is in lead from columns. They're gonna come up the Baltimore Pike, they're gonna cut over what we know today as Knight Road. You know Knight Road? Come up the Baltimore Pike, I'm sorry, cut over Golden Road, Hospital Road, come just south of the Chuck Wagon, and turn left, and go all the way down to Rock Creek to water the horses. Then they're going to come back up and make a left on Knight Road. Okay? Come across Knight Road and start to deploy down where today is Ridge Road. Way down there. And they'll start to push forward. The 1st Vermont has some skirmishers out, and they'll start pushing up, and in the D. Curran's house that was occupied at the time of the battle by D. Frozel, the one out by the bowling alley, the stone house that's had a new facade put on it, just on the southeast corner of that intersection. There's some Alabama skirmishers down there that Law has stationed there, and they're going to push the Alabama skirmishers. Some men from Troop L will go out and occupy that house. That's on the far left of the Vermont line. And they won't come back until it's time to do the main part of the charge. Okay, this is why another reason why I don't think Henry Parsons is in any position to hear any kind of argument that took place. He's a captain, he's on extended duty, and Kilpatrick's going to eventually have his headquarters up on Bushman Hill. Now, get here, Kilpatrick tells Farnsworth, you go deploy the men, your brigade, I'll place the guns. Okay, and he puts Elder's battery, the only battery that he has with Farnsworth Brigade. Elder's battery did not come up with Merritt from Emmitsburg, contrary to Hunterstown. Can't fight at Hunterstown from Emmitsburg. So he came up and he would place Elder's battery. In some accounts has Elder divided, but at least two guns out of the four. He has four Rodman rifles, rifled guns. And starts to push forward, and they will act as the brigade skirmish line. One battalion of the Vermonters. Now, if you divide a regiment into battalions, a regiment, these cavalry regiments had 12 troops or companies. There were three battalions in the regiment, four companies or troops in each one. Okay, and one of the battalions was on skirmish line. The other two will participate in the charge. Okay, only eight companies participate in the final charge. Coming up left, two battalions are behind them with the 1st West Virginia on the left and the 1st Vermont on the right. Got that? Okay. As they come into position, the Confederate batteries are positioned up here. One battery Bachman, South Carolina battery is positioned behind this stone wall. Four Napoleons. Right back here, stretching down over the rise, but mainly taking advantage of this high ground. And behind them and a little to their right, and perhaps even as far as the Emmitsburg Road and maybe even across the Emmitsburg Road, another battery of six guns. Two Parrott rifles, two ordnance rifles, and two Napoleons. Okay, two of their guns are captured guns from Smith's battery down at Devil's Den the day before. Okay, that's Riley's battery from North Carolina. But there are 10 cannons on this ridge with no infantry support. Okay, and I think Kilpatrick from Bushman Hill can see this. He sends out his reconnaissance because he's supposed to hit the Confederate right. Go find me the Confederate right. Oh man, we can't make a charge down through there. There's boulders and everything. We're up the hill, we can't get there. Okay, fine, what about those 10 cannons up there on the ridge? And you saw a picture, this is all open. And you can ride a horse across this, I've done it. And stone walls like this at a gallop are nothing for a horse to go over. And even Henry Parsons, who says there's no way we should have charged over those fences, those stone walls, later in his account has his horse miraculously leaping all four of those walls. With no injury to the horse. And the horse has already been shot, and he's got blood oozing out of his neck. Okay, so it's whatever is appropriate here. But these cannons are sitting up here all by themselves. The very first thing that occurs is Elder gets up on Bushman Hill, Elder's battery. Two out of four, maybe even four, and I don't know who was up there originally. The four guns eventually get there, but at first I'm not sure. Guns are up there. The Confederates start to spot the Vermonters. Remember, erase all these trees. Erase all those trees. Okay, you gotta do some fancy work here. And start hurling shells. These Napoleons start sending solid shot down there. One of the first solid shots hits in the middle of the 5th New York Cavalry, killing Daniel Hurley of Company C, and wounding badly J&O Buckley, one shot. The next shot took out a couple of horses. The third shot, finally, somebody asked permission to move out of line. So they shift the 5th New York right behind Elder's battery on the back slope of Bushman Hill. The 18th Pennsylvania moves into a wood line, which is just over the right site. Okay, so now they're protected. The 18th Pennsylvania is under Lieutenant Colonel William Brinton. Okay. Anyway, and John Hammond, Colonel John Hammond of the 5th. They're moving over slightly. So this artillery exchange continues for a little while. And then Farnsworth and Kilpatrick have their discussion. And at some point, they become convinced that the battery can be captured. So they take the 1st West Virginia. Let me see that account of the 1st West Virginia. Go ahead, John.
Andy, now, are the 1st Texas deployed as skirmishers at this point up forward of these batteries?
They've been driven in. The skirmishers are driven in as the cavalry comes in. Skirmishers, the very first line of vedettes, the second line of skirmishers, and now everybody's back to the stone wall.
In front, right up
right
here.
Right in front of us.
And what about, none of the Georgians are in this area here?
Not yet. No, they're down.
They're all over here, because I've seen maps. Okay.
Later in the event. The 9th Georgia will come back. Otherwise, they've got their hands full with Merritt, and they're pretty far down past the Ridge Road intersection, for the most part. They'll be driven back over a mile by Merritt's troopers. By the time Merritt's thing starts to die down is when the 1st Virginia is going to do their charge. Now, it's going to be the 1st West Virginia, because less than a month earlier than this, West Virginia becomes a state. But let me just give you a real quick picture of who these men are. It's composed of superior material, mostly young men from the farms, experienced horsemen and marksmen who could break and tame the wildest colt or pierce the head of a squirrel at the top of the tallest hickory with a rifle bullet. Okay, let's see. They've all got white horses. It's going to be a grand spectacle, okay? That's the synopsis of the 1st West Virginia. Well, anyway, they're one of the most veteran units that Farnsworth has, also the 1st Vermont. They're going to be told to make the first part of the charge. They're going to come out of the trees. Bushman Hill had some trees on it. The thing is, they're going to hit them where they're the thickest, down over the bottom of the hill. Now, as soon as that occurs, as soon as they hit, the 1st Texans say, we waited. We saw them mount for their charge, not 200 yards in front of us. I mean, they're almost within carbine range, pretty close. But we waited until they charged. And it wasn't until they were almost right on top of us that we were given the order to fire.
Well, what time was this?
Unloaded a bunch of saddles. This is going to be 3:30.
Okay, I thought it was like 1:30, the first West Virginia. But it's not.
It's going to be later than that.
Is it?
Okay. Yes, I'm certain it's much later than that. Now, the first Virginia charges, I'll say 3 o'clock. And when they charge, some of the men, they hit the wall this way to try to get around the stone wall. The stone wall ends somewhere up just inside the tree line there to the right of that statue. And the rail fence across at an angle back toward the Emmitsburg Road. So they're going to come to the end of the stone wall and try to jump the rail fence where the line is thinner. And some of the 1st West Virginia troopers are going to come in and actually get in among the guns of Bachman's battery. Bachman account. Say that. Some of the, as this charge is taking place, the 18th Pennsylvania is told to get into the works. By the time the 18th Pennsylvania, which is to their right, actually, after they've moved, remember they move into the woods because of the cannon fire, the 18th Pennsylvania actually doesn't get moving and into the charge until the 1st West Virginia is pretty much finished and coming back. So it makes it like a second attack. The second wave of the charge is the 18th Pennsylvania, and then the third and final is the 1st Vermont. So let's get the cars and go down around the curve, down to the base of the hill, and stop down there by the lane so that we can see the 18th Pennsylvania.
Going up the horse trail here on the East Confederate. The 18th Pennsylvania monument.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah. 21st Pennsylvania, that's another one. Okay. This is a picture of what Elder's Battery looks like on top of Bushman Hill. This is in the 1890s. However, 1897, circa. However, during the battle, the trees, even the ones that are showing, were only as high as the top of the hill. The batteries could shoot over them, even though they were fully leaved in July, if they just raised their cannons to their highest elevation. So Elder was actually shooting at Bachman over there, but he couldn't see him because the top of the trees was away and the hunters had to elevate their guns. Now this monument, along with the 5th New York Cavalry, is continue up the horse trail and it curves around and goes to the peak of Bushman Hill, and they're up there. I am opting not to take you up there because there's nothing up there but those two monuments and you can't see the field from there. Hopefully someday we will be able to.
Is it your opinion that the rock there is the argument rock or not?
What argument?
Okay, the discussion rock.
That's the alleged, yes. This is the 5th Vermont, I mean the 5th New York. Monument that's also up there. Notice again the open nature of the terrain up there. Even in the 1890s, it was even more open during the battle. And this is the monument in front of which Carol Merrill was now standing. Okay. Pretty open, huh?
Huh.
Okay. Now, one of the veterans of this regiment tells us that the monument's in the wrong place. who's supposed to be out on the extreme left in a house occupied earlier by Alabama. I rode to the front and found Kilpatrick standing by his horse. He showed great impatience and eagerness for orders. The great opportunity that was to have hurled his two brigades across the open fields upon the right and rear of Pickett's broken columns has been allowed to pass. As I turned away, an orderly dashed by, shouting, "We turned the charge, 9 acres of prisoners." That's Pickett's charge. Okay. In a moment, an aide came down, and Kilpatrick sprang into his saddle and rode toward him. The verbal order I heard delivered was, "Hood's division is turning, or pressing, our left. Play all your guns, charge in their rear, create a strong diversion." That's supposed to be Kilpatrick. In a moment, Farnsworth rode up. Kilpatrick impetuously repeated the order. Farnsworth, who was a tall man with military bearing, received the order in silence. It was repeated. Farnsworth spoke with emotion. "General, do you mean it? Shall I throw my handful of men over rough ground through timber against a brigade of infantry?" Kilpatrick said, "A handful? You have the four best regiments in the army." Now this is where it gets interesting. Farnsworth supposedly answered, "But you forget, the 1st Michigan is detached." Really peculiar, since the 1st Michigan was never attached. Okay? But it was with Custer's brigade, right? Yeah. "The 5th New York you have sent beyond call." If you've been listening, where's the 5th Vermont? The 5th New York, right behind Elder's Gun. They're not beyond call, they're right beside the 1st Vermont. Okay? Actually, that's where they were. "And I have nothing left but the 1st Vermont and the 1st West Virginia regiments who have fought half to pieces." And now that's really interesting, since these two regiments don't fight at Brandy Station, Aldi, Upperville. The brunt of the fighting at Hanover is the 18th Pennsylvania, the 5th New York. And the 18th Pennsylvania is mysteriously omitted from this report altogether, the Farnsworth little memory session. Anyway, even at Hunterstown, it was Custer's brigade, right? Mostly. So these guys haven't really been full half yet. Anyways, Farnsworth supposedly continues, "They are too good men to kill." As opposed to men who are not good enough and we should kill. Okay. Yeah. And Kilpatrick, you know, you can just imagine Kilpatrick going, "No, they're not. Kill them anyway. Let's kill them."
Cavalry.
Okay. Kilpatrick turned, greatly excited, and said, "Do you refuse to obey my orders? If you're afraid to lead this charge, then I will lead it." Farnsworth rose in his stirrups and leaned forward with his saber half drawn. He looked magnificent in his passion. "Oh, come on," and cried, "take that back." Kilpatrick rose defiantly, but repentingly said, "I did not mean it. Forget it." For a moment, nothing was said when Farnsworth spoke calmly, "General, if you order the charge, I will lead it, but you must take the awful responsibility." Now that isn't quite the Battles and Leaders account. You see, they took out all that stuff about the wrong regiments. They took out all the stuff that didn't make sense and just made it, you know, almost as colorful. But haven't you heard some rendition of that? Okay. Now, Evander Law relates this story in 1876 when asked by John Batchelder to tell him what of this argument. Law says, "Just before the charge was made, the men of the 1st Texas Regiment, on picket, heard someone in a loud, angry voice say, 'Colonel, are you never going to attack? By God, if you're afraid to do it, I will lead the charge myself.' The attack followed at once. I suppose, from what I've learned since, that it was General Kilpatrick addressing Farnsworth, whose commission, found in his pocket, was only 5 or 6 days old. Therefore, the address, 'Colonel.'" Was Farnsworth ever a colonel?
No, he was a captain.
No, he wasn't. He skipped that rank. Okay. Now another Harry Potter. Harry Potter says, okay, he says Kilpatrick went rushing up to the 18th Pennsylvania. 18th Pennsylvania was being commanded by Lieutenant Colonel William Brenton. And that he said to Colonel Brenton, "Why in hell and damnation don't you move those troops out?" At this point, Kilpatrick could have been addressing William Brenton, who led the regiment in the charge. Now, I'm going to assert that the 18th Pennsylvania, even if this is not the center of the line, they were here, somewhere close by. If this marks the left of their line, so be it. They were in this area. William Brenton could easily have been in this area also. The first Texas skirmish line is right behind those boulders. They would have been lined up, the stone wall down at the road, it bends in some areas. They could have been easily right behind those boulders. They could have had their little listening glasses out. And anything that occurred in this area is definitely within earshot. Wouldn't you agree? If William Brenton is standing here and Kilpatrick rides up to him, and I suggest that it occurred while the 1st West Virginia was charging to our left, you notice there's a little bit of an open hollow area down there. Well, all of that would have been open on the other side of that stone wall down there. All that would have been open for yards back, at least 100 yards back, and the 1st West Virginia is going to charge right across that open hollow when they make their first attack. And when the 1st West Virginia starts to fall back and Kilpatrick's up on the hill, I think he rides down here to the 18th Pennsylvania and says to Colonel William Brenton, and these are new guys, 18th Pennsylvania, they're rookies. Why in hell and damnation aren't you helping them? You know? Where did the orders fail us? But again, he's talking to the colonel of the 18th Pennsylvania, and I think the 1st Texans are hearing it. Quite possibly some of their advanced guys just sneaking behind the boulders. And I think that explains Law's account, which is repeated, and in Law's mind, it endorses Parsons. Okay? Because he believes that his Texas men heard the same argument. Okay?
Now, you think the skirmish line was up here and not down along the stone wall at the road?
Perhaps the main line was, but I think some of them have come forward and are probably up along here. Also, the stone wall, at some point, there is a stone wall up in here that continues down that way, and I think in a lot of areas they are up. And on Kathy George's map, if you've looked at that real closely, she has them all up here.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's quite possible, yeah, that they're this close. So I think that explains the whole colonel thing. Okay? And I don't think that Henry Parsons would have heard any of it. Now, Potter's account says that and Potter says there was no argument. Potter says the alleged argument, if anybody would have heard it, he says, it would have been me, the bugler, and Farnsworth and Kilpatrick. And those four people were the only people that would have been in a position to hear any argument if it did take place. And he says that they were right in front of the big rock where the monument is today, like you said. This big rock, in front of this big rock were standing those four individuals, and behind that was Kilpatrick's staff. And that Kilpatrick's headquarters was right up there in front of the 5th New York Monument. But the staff was down behind the rock, and in front of the rock is where this discussion took place. And the discussion, in his account, went something like this. I don't think we ought to charge the infantry. Okay, well then what are we going to charge? You know? Well, how about that battery? If you're up on Bushman Hill and to your right it's really deep and rocky and nasty looking and the infantry's in strong force up there on the hill, look over there and you see 10 guns sitting out in the middle of nowhere with no infantry support. Let's attack the guns. Okay? So first to 1st Virginia, and then once William Brenton gets his act together, the 18th Pennsylvania hits the Texans also.
So they get down about, what, Bushman House or Farm and then turn around?
The 18th Pennsylvania doesn't even get that far.
The first
West Virginia, some of them get in there, but it's just small pieces of them. Most of them are falling back. The 18th Pennsylvania, they hit right exactly where they're their thickest. And they say that the Texans just came out of the ground as if like a swarm of bees. They were all over them. And so there's some hand-to-hand fighting down in there, but the charge doesn't go any further. And these guys, again, it's like their first battle.
But their objective, obviously, wasn't the guns. Their objective was that the infantry, that skirmish line.
No, they're going through the infantry to flank the guns.
To flank the guns.
They're after that battery. Because capture the battery, and that's going to cause some bit of a ruckus.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's exactly what they were after. And the accounts indicate that the objective was the battery.
In the first charge.
In 1st West Virginia and the 18th Pennsylvania. I also think in the 1st Vermont, except they're going to be a little craftier about it.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to outflank them because the fire from the battery is very deadly, and it's helping Now, the 1st West Virginia doesn't get too much of the battery fire because it's going over their heads. And Bachman talks about it, you know, they're down too far underneath. The 18th Pennsylvania is going to get a little bit of it when they come out from under the trees, but the 1st Vermont is going to get a much larger because they're going to come from around the other side of the hill. 1st Vermont is still back here behind us at this point in time. They're seeing how desperate this is right here where the 1st Texans are. So at one point, Farnsworth is going to decide to come around the hill. And he's going to outflank the battery in a much wider circle. And that's why he gets out into, you know, Sliders Meadow. Mm-hmm.
Okay. But when he does his recon on this wide sweep, he's going up the hill towards that D-shaped field looking at the rocks.
Don't say D-shaped.
What am I supposed to say? Slider Meadow?
Yeah, okay. Say Meadow. Because you know what? It wasn't D-shaped until they cut the new road in the 1930s. Because they cut the road right through the middle of the meadow.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, but yeah. But no. I'll talk about that later. Let me get down to where we can see. Let's go down to the Wells Monument. Okay?
One, doesn't it fly in the face of everything you hear about Civil War artillery for them to be firing and not see what they're doing?
Not see what they're doing.
Yeah, not seeing the damage, not seeing where they're hitting friendly people.
I think the gunners can't see, but I do think they have reports of their guys can climb trees or they can go out and they can scout it and they can say, here's, you know, they can see the smoke coming up from the battery and they're going to aim at that. And they say that they were very effective. And Bachman's account and Elder's accounts are both saying it was effective fire. So even though they couldn't see it, the gunners, I think somebody could and was telling them the coordinates or else they were just using the smoke.
Have you looked at either straight up on the web for the park?
Right up.
He's got a website.
Mm-hmm. No, I haven't.
Okay. Down at the overlook at the Slider Farm on East Confederate.
So Wells and Farnsworth in their battalion are going to change the route of their charge. They decide to go to the right of this knoll. Now remember, they're down there facing us. They're going to come around to the back and come out where there was an opening. The entire area along Plum Run and on both sides of the banks for 100 yards probably, 50 yards on either side of Plum Run, is open. There is a little skirt of timber around Bushman Hill, and the peak is open. Can you imagine that? Just a ring of timber around the hill, and then right along Plum Run, open terrain. In the back of Bushman Hill, there's open terrain. And the 1st Vermont is going to move to the right around the hill and come up in that open territory along this side of Plum Run and begin to move to the charge. You see where William Wells is? He's facing the enemy. The charge comes right out of there. Law says he saw it. Law was here for the dedication of that statue, and he says they came out from cover of the woods right here.
Was he up there?
He was
there?
Up there. Up on the ridge, so he could see. This was all open in here. 1st Vermont charges. There's a stone wall back there at one of those first stone walls. Farnsworth's horse gets wounded. He falls from his horse, and William Wells tells another one of the non-commissioned officers, I think a corporal, to get off his horse, Corporal Freeman, I believe it is, and give Farnsworth his horse.
It wasn't the bugler then.
Wasn't the bugler, no.
It wasn't over here.
Well, it wasn't the bugler. You mean up there by Slider? Mm-hmm. That's Parsons' account.
Right.
Okay. The best I can tell you is we can interpret Parsons or we can interpret the rest, because in this instance, Parsons is not with Farnsworth. And I think that whoever Parsons is talking to, or if he's talking to nobody about it, he's making it up as he goes along because he's not there. But we do have accounts. I'll tell you, the surgeon's accounts, both surgeons write accounts of where they found his body. And the men that were with him, and E.A. Paul, and everybody else that's watching, says they came this way. Other men who rode in the charge say we went to the right around the knoll. Okay? So we have to put him over there.
But in terms of the wounding, why would you say it was down here?
It happened after the first stone wall, after he crossed the first stone wall. This is the second one. Okay? They're only a couple rods from each other, but mm-hmm. they say that his horse went down after he crosses the first stone wall, and then after the second one.
Whose account? It says.
After the first stone wall, there's several of them, after the first stone wall, I have to get you the names. There's enough of them. It's not just one. There's enough of them that I'm using it. Stephen Clark would probably be one of them. I use pretty heavily. And there's several others in the 1st Vermont. And I can tell you when I get back to my car.
Okay.
Also, then Farnsworth's battalion, when they come out from under the cover of the woods, will get some fire from one of Bachman's left section. They're already firing over here toward Elder on the peak of the hill. They see Farnsworth emerge, and they're going to start firing at Farnsworth too. I think that's where Farnsworth gets hit, because in his in the surgeon's account, he's got a bunch of bullet wounds on him, but he's also got a piece of shrapnel in his high up in his right thigh. So it could have been that artillery fragment that took him down. And then they cross this wall, and then they move out into the open meadow. And I think their attempt then is to flank the battery. Now, Parsons' account has Farnsworth coming from the other side of the hill, which refutes everything the participants say about going to the right, and the monument, and the later account. Parsons says they came out right up under the noses of the battery, and then they ducked in this way and came up along the road, and went up the hill, past the D-shaped field, went behind the infantry, and then all the way down to the Slider farm, and then emerged out there, and then started riding their way back. Okay? That is Parsons' account. Other accounts have them coming out this way, going up toward the Slider house, turning left and charging, like as if they were going to go around the left flank of the battery. But Law is very observant, and Law will take Bachman's battery from facing south and turn them, pull them back behind the stone wall where we were, and face across this valley. So when Farnsworth emerges, begins to head for the battery directly. The battery's facing the Vermonters. Okay? So now, Farnsworth gets badly beaten. A lot of his men separate. Some of them turn to the right and go back towards the Slider farm. And Parsons is told to get into the fight. Parsons comes right across here, going directly for where Farnsworth is, goes straight out across the Slider meadow toward the Slider farm. Now, if you go by Parsons' account, this is after Farnsworth has done this huge end around, which I interpret that to mean he's really trying to outflank the battery. He emerges at the Slider farm, and lo and behold, Bachman's cannons are facing right at the Slider farm because of Parsons. Rode right out across the meadow, like, "Hey, Bachman, over here, we're coming this way, aim at us." And as soon as Farnsworth, would have already outflanked the battery, been behind them, suddenly finds out that the battery is facing him because Parsons rode right across the meadow. So I was starting to think, even interpreting Parsons' account, that he must be culpable for Farnsworth's death, because had he not done that, then Farnsworth would have been around behind the battery and had a prayer of charging them and taking the gun. You can't charge them head on, okay? They're Napoleons. You gotta outflank them. So that's Parsons' account. The other accounts say that, you know, Farnsworth gets out there in trouble. Parsons gets sent in directly to help him. He goes to his aid. And in the melee that occurs out here, most of Parsons' men reform behind the Slider barn and then make their way out by going up behind the infantry, up toward that meadow. They get hit in that meadow by some Alabama soldiers, and there's a big fight up in the meadow, and a couple other people are wounded badly. Farnsworth and his men try to make it out the same way they came in. And the reason that I believe this is because William Oates, who isn't necessarily reliable because he changes his story on certain accounts, on certain issues, time after time, but he wrote at least 6 accounts of this, okay? And actually, he's actually consistent on a couple of things. Now, remember, Oates is up on Big Round Top, the farthest regiment on the right. He gets orders to go to the support of the battery, because Law realizes it's the battery they're after. Go to the support of the battery. So Oates' men turn. Without doing a countermarch, they come down the hill, rear in front. Oates tells us where he thinks his battery is. It's on a knoll 200 yards behind him, directly in his rear. Where's that? Right here. Elder's guns are here. He thinks that's Riley's guns, and he's going straight for that knoll to support his own guns. They're not his guns, but his men run down the hill. They cross over Plum Run, which he identifies as the same muddy creek we crossed yesterday. And they begin to go into the skirt of timber, rising the hill. And it's at that time that his forward elements, his skirmishers that are about 30 paces, he says, in front of his infantry, meet with Farnsworth. That's Farnsworth on his return ride, coming back almost to his own lines. And he runs into the 15th Alabama down there. Okay, that's Oates' account. Repeated accounts of where he says he ran into Farnsworth. You've got the Parsons account, you've got some other accounts. It's hard to say exactly what happened, but I say most of the evidence leans toward the accounts other than Parsons. I mean, Parsons' account comes out in 1887. All the accounts after that seem to go with him. They figure he studied it, will echo basically his account. The ones that are written before that have a different path. And the guys that rode with Farnsworth tell us a different path. But since Parsons wasn't with Farnsworth, I'm going to have to go with them. Okay? Any questions about that?
Isn't it a long way for Law to order Oates back to support?
Law was up on the ridge, and he sent a courier, he said. He sent a courier, first of all, to go straight across the valley as fast as he could. Go up to the infantry line, he said, the first regiment you come to, tell them to turn to the rear and come back to stop to get in the middle of this cavalry problem out here in the meadow. He goes and tells the 4th Alabama, and then he tells the same messenger, after you move that first regiment you come to, tell them to come to the rear, then go all the way to the end of the line and tell that regiment to also come to the rear. He's trying to surround them. And Law is awesome in this engagement because he moves his players like men on a chessboard, you know. He moves the 4th Alabama to come down and to get involved. He will also then pull the 9th Georgia from the Emmitsburg Road down facing south against Merritt. He also pulls the 9th Georgia back to support Bachman's battery, because Bachman's battery is the one under the attack. When Farnsworth finally gets his attack together to charge right at the battery, where he has no other choice because the battery is now turned to face him, he is going to also be, Bachman is also going to be supported by the 9th Georgia Infantry. And it's infantry fire that really repels Farnsworth's charge, not necessarily the canister fire. But that's when they start to head back in this direction. And I think Farnsworth and his men try to get right back through the open area just like they came from, because it is hard to ride a horse through all this boulder terrain.
You don't think they were up on the hill?
I think maybe Parsons and some of them do go up there. Mm-hmm. But I don't think Farnsworth does, because I think that's two separate charges. And I believe that Parsons' account of his own battalion's progress is accurate.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't think he knew what happened to Farnsworth.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think that some of the men of Farnsworth's battalion, after they come out here and they go out in toward Slider Farm and they turn to the left, and this is all on the Batchelder map too if you look at it, they start charging the battery, they come back. Some of them come back, some of them go to the right and maybe get in with Parsons and go with him, because there's so much confusion. But I think that Farnsworth and a small group of men along with William Wells come back this way. And I think they are the ones that Oates runs into. Now, the surgeon who found Farnsworth's body says, out along the Bushman Road, or one of the driveway, and one time I thought there was one across the meadow, but that doesn't look right. I think this might be the second one, and I'm not sure, but I think this might be the second one, and the first one I think might be right back there. And if all these trees are cleared, and the artillerymen are looking this way and they see the cavalry start, if Farnsworth isn't out in the very front, he could have gotten hit by canister round.
You don't think this is the first one? I just was looking at maps. I just wondered what map you were looking at.
Well, there's one in Pennsylvania, Gettysburg.
Mm-hmm.
There's the crop map.
Mm-hmm.
There's not too many maps that show the stone wall. I think the one in Pennsylvania Gettysburg is my favorite with the stone walls. You know, Warren map, the Batchelder map, none of them go down that far south. So I think that one does, and I think the crop map does. Those are the two that I go with. Let's move over here to the Wells Monument.
Got this chart map, and I got a watercolor map, which is a compilation of maps.
Yeah, that's the one.
Yeah.
You were finishing. I didn't think that was a complete comment.
Well, it's just that for the sake of your argument, and I'm you know, and you're
mm-hmm.
going to have to, you know, when you write this and the documentation of it and questions that would come up,
right,
in terms of, okay, how do you know that wall was there? And
yeah,
and that was the first wall, or was this his first wall? And because, you know, to making that assertion, you want to make sure, obviously, you know, that...
Yeah, that's important, because they all talk about the walls. First, I think...
Because you know that D-shaped deal stuck in people's head, you know?
Well, not until Cross put it there.
Well, I know, but...
D-shape wasn't ever used until he put it there. But the thing is, you know, if you believe the Parsons, then you got to find your walls over there.
Uh-huh.
First, you got to figure out where the route is, then pick the walls.
Uh-huh.
And that's why I just recently, I've chosen these two walls. First of all, they say they're only several rods
mm-hmm. apart.
Apart,
mm-hmm.
And also, I think that I've got enough accounts that say they came from this direction.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I think this monument you've been telling, you know, they say in the monument dedications that the charge came out, you mm-hmm. know, this spot, mm-hmm. and here he is facing the enemy. I think that's the route they were taking. I wanted to point out these guys on this bas-relief, which looks really crappy right now. But do you know that each one of these has an identity? Okay? This is William Wells. Okay? He's the guy that survives. He's a Vermonter. And he's shown at the front waving his saber. Here, hold this one. Okay? Yeah, it's 22-year-old David Freeman that gives him the horse when he falls. Anyway, the guy that has to abandon his horse to General Farnsworth, when Farnsworth's horse gets back to his line. And I think that would be a little impossible if it happened out at the Slider farm. This guy's right back here. When it happens, he can easily get back to the Union lines on foot. Anyway, this is Farnsworth falling back on his horse, mortally wounded. And, then, Henry Parsons. See Parsons? Maybe that's how he saw the charge. Yeah, I wouldn't think so. Let's see. Then you have Sergeant Stranahan. And, let's see. This is Alfonso Barrows, who has to jump off his horse. This is George Duncan, who gets killed. Duncan gets killed, I think, up in the meadow. Because I think part of Parsons' battalion gets into some hand-to-hand up in there.
Is he the white duster? No.
No, that's Cushman. Lieutenant. And Cushman isn't pictured here. Let's see. Which one is number 15? I think it is. They say this one is Cushman. See, most of the guys in here are Troop L, Parsons' troop, and it is mostly a picture of the fight, I think, up in the meadow, only Parsons and Wells have been added. I mean, Wells and Farnsworth have been added to the front of it. But anyway, this monument went up in 1913, 50 years after the battle, and Evander Law gave a speech. And Henry Parsons was dead already by the time this monument went up. And this is another one of the controversies. Where exactly did Farnsworth fall? Where did this charge take place, and where did his life end? What I want to assert is that in the late 1880s, when this brigade, each regiment had some representatives, went around the field and placed and chose spots for the regimental monument. The 1st Vermont chose the meadow up on the hill. The 18th Pennsylvania, the 5th New York, they had already placed theirs in the wrong place and it'll have to be moved later, but everybody chooses the spot for their monument. They also, at the same time, choose the location for a brigade monument. The brigade monument location was marked by a pile of cannonballs. And never used. The brigade monument never went up. It was supposed to be a pentagonal shaft with a life-size standing portrait of General Farnsworth at the top, and on each of the five sides of the pentagonal shaft was to be information about the four regiments of the battery. And it was supposed to be on a pile of boulders. And I believe that spot was this spot. The park takes this as the brigade monument. Okay. I think...
When was that?
This was in when there. I have the newspaper report.
Mm-hmm.
It's in 1898, I think. They talk about this. When 1888 is when they come around and choose the mm-hmm. the sites. And then I think when they find out that the 5th New York Monument's in the wrong place, the veterans are comment about all these monuments. Oates writes an account about the site that was chosen for the Brigade Monument. And Oates says that the monument, the pile of cannonballs marking the spot for the Brigade Monument is in the wrong place because they wanted it to mark the spot where Farnsworth fell.
Mm.
And General Oates says, at the time, it's 150 yards south of that spot where Farnsworth fell. And if you get south, it's that way. If you get a compass, do you have a compass on your mind?
I got one right here. I got one.
Many letters. would Farnsworth be carrying that were addressed to Brigadier General E.J. Farnsworth? Mail would have to be pretty darn fast.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Okay, he didn't even have time to get a uniform. He borrowed Pleasanton's uniform. In any case, he said Oates gives the same commentary three or four times. Then he's invited to come to Gettysburg in 1888 by John Batchelder, probably with the rest of the members of his brigade, and he declines the offer. And then later, he's faced with the evidence. The evidence is this man, Ptolemy Edson, the surgeon who looked at the body, says that there weren't any bullet holes in Farnsworth's head. When found, the body was stripped to a flannel shirt and drawers and stockings. There were 5 bullet wounds upon the body, 4 in the chest and abdomen, and 1 high up in the thigh. He had no wound or inner injury of any sort in the head or face. In view of these facts, it seems improbable at least that General Farnsworth had any need to shoot himself, though Colonel Oates, who claims to have seen it, was undoubtedly there and has declared that it was suicide. General Farnsworth certainly did not blow his own brains out, nor did anyone do it for him. Okay? That's true. Now, when Oates is faced with this evidence, he changes his story. Well, I didn't exactly see it. I saw it imperfectly through the trees. And he also then says, okay, maybe they didn't say he shot himself in the head. I was certain that they said it was in his head, but probably it was somewhere else. They must have said it was his chest. Okay, then he prints his book in 1905, and Oates' quote is exactly as it was, only instead of shot himself in the head, he says shot himself in the heart. Okay, here's my assertion. Think about this. Maybe those men on his skirmish line did see somebody shoot themselves, whether by accident or on purpose. Maybe it wasn't Farnsworth. Maybe it was somebody else. The surgeon himself offers the following. General Farnsworth was described by the rebels, and I've read the accounts, of wearing a white havelock. The general did not wear one. Captain Cushman, Company E, who rode near him, did. He wore a white handkerchief behind his cap that also fell upon his neck and shoulders. He also wore a white duck jacket with gold braid all over it. A woman back home had made it for him and sent it to Oliver Cushman and said, this is a jacket that no bullet will penetrate. And when he put it on that morning, he said, this might be just the day for magic mail. So he put on this white flamboyant jacket. Parsons says he told him to take it off. He wore it anyway. But anyway, he wears this jacket, and throughout the entire charge, he is mistaken as Farnsworth. Why not possibly that he was still mistaken for Farnsworth when he got shot? Because guess what happens to Cushman? He gets shot in the head. A terrible face wound. All right? Cushman's wound enters under the right jaw, goes up under his mouth, and out near right underneath his left eye. They say, though, that he was fighting on the ground. So if he was fighting on the ground, he's either on his knees or standing. It's hard to believe anyone else could have gotten that trajectory on him. But couldn't he have shot himself? I don't think he's the kind of guy to commit suicide. He's supporting his family back home. His mother, his father, is paying the mortgage on the farm. He's sending home hundreds, $400 at a time. I don't think he would have committed suicide, but couldn't he have shot himself accidentally? Could this be what they saw? Farnsworth is described in the Confederate accounts as having light-colored hair and mustache. Or having light-colored hair, yeah. Not mustache, but just light-colored hair. He didn't have light-colored hair. I think it's a case of mistaken identity. And whether Cushman shot himself, or whether he shot him, or somebody shot him, it could easily be, and if he turned the gun on himself, even in a moment of terror, it could have looked just like if he shot himself, or shot his brains out. They said, some of the accounts say they saw him shoot his brains out. His brains came out. Well, you know, if you shot yourself like that, something's going to come out. Maybe it's his face instead of his brain. But anyway, Cushman will live, but not long enough to settle this for him. You only lives one more year than he died at Paul's Church. Hmm. Paul's Church. Paul's Shop. I'm sorry. In Cold Harbor. He dies with the colonel of the regiment. So he's not here to tell us. But I think it might be a case of mistaken identity. Okay? That's my suicide thing. So you heard the solution that I have for the suicide, for the argument, the death site, and I'm depending almost completely on Oates and the surgeons and the shape and the where this monument is and what Law says where he saw them emerge from the trees. Even to get my route of the charge. Also, this route of the charge would be consistent with Batchelder as well. It's on the Batchelder maps. They came out of this area. So Farnsworth was killed on the return trip. I don't think Parsons was anywhere near here. And the regimental history says they all fell near each other. I don't think so. Okay, I think Cushman and Farnsworth fell together, and I think Duncan and Farrington or whoever else is up there with Parsons.
Mm-hmm.
Might have fallen up there, and I think Parsons is going through the whole charge, probably delirious, and then finally exits to the rear of the 15th Alabama. So we have one more stop. Let's make it real quick. They were trying to make it,
just clear
know,
it.
Look a little bit like a meadow, I guess. Here's the Tipton photo of the first Vermont from 1897 pass. Here is the first Vermont at the right after the dedication, all spanking white.
Wow.
And in the middle of its meadow. Okay. This monument says,
down
somewhere near the road.
Well, that's not the south wall. That would be the west wall. Talking about the one that this doesn't isn't a wall. It's in the middle of it.
Okay. So anyway, you have to wonder. If Gary Cross is measuring 150 yards that way, that's not south. You can verify that. South is that way.
Well, he's lucky. At least the public can be in his place.
Well, true. But then he could rewrite his article. So then I thought, well, I'm smart. I have this compass. I know south is that way. So maybe Gary's almost right. But maybe if you measure in the right direction, you'll find it. So me and a couple of my more willing compadres tried to get a tape measure through that thicket.
Get out.
Didn't work. He only got like 2 feet in. Paul Cooksey, you know, he tried to push the thicket over and that didn't work either. But anyway, we figured, well, then it's on the other side of the road about, and this monument is about 75 yards from the current day's road. Another 75 yards on the other side is what we thought, 150, we got it. Well, that was fine for a while until I realized that this isn't the monument Oates was talking about. He was talking about that pile of cannonballs down there where they put the Wells monument. This was never intended as a brigade site. This was picked out when all the guys got together in the 1880s and chose this as their regimental site. They don't use that for Wells until the brigade monument falls apart. Okay? And he's talking about the pile of cannonballs down there at the Wells monument. This is all developing research. Then you have Wittenberg, Eric Wittenberg, on the other hand. He says that Farnsworth was found near the location of the present-day monument to 1st Vermont Cavalry. He means right here. Farnsworth died right in here, Wittenberg said. The basis for this opinion is, he says, the presence of another monument base located on the battlefield. He says, the current position of the 1st Vermont Cavalry is not the original location. He didn't have that photograph of the dedication that I just showed you. It was moved sometime in the 20th century from a position about 150 feet, yards he means, to the north from where it stands today. Where does he think north is? That way. It's not. Okay. The original foundation for the monument is still visible if one knows where to look. If you go north from here, and I've had people who have come into the visitor center saying, I went north from that monument and there's nothing out there. They're out there 150
Swamp.
Feet, yards, whatever, sloshing around in the thicket. And they come in and go, I can't find anything. Okay. So then, they just think that they don't know where to look. That's what they said. Okay. Many accounts have Farnsworth falling about 150 feet, he means yards, from the site of the 1st Vermont's monument. However, it must be remembered that most of those accounts were written before the monument was moved. Supposedly it was never moved. Therefore, the author believes that the modern interpretation would place Farnsworth's death site near the monument to Major Wells, and Gary's the only one that places him down the hill, is incorrect. He thinks Gary's incorrect. I think he's right about that. Rather, the author believes the actual site for it is near, very near or at the spot of the 1st Vermont monument. Okay? Now, we have to get up the hill. He says the 1st Vermont's monument, which is surrounded by a triangular stone wall, much like that described in some of the accounts. I think he's reading second day accounts of the triangular field. But in any case, now listen, the 1st Vermont Cavalry Monument was never moved. It was placed in its current position on October 9th, 1889, according to the Vermont Commissioner's report on the dedication ceremony. Dated 1890, it says the procession then moved through the cavalry monument on Kilpatrick Avenue, which is here, going right across the meadow. And one of those pictures shows Kilpatrick Avenue.
So where did it go?
It came in. There's an opening in the fence somewhere in the stone wall. Uh-huh. Came in, came by this monument, went back out the other side.
Did it hook up to the Confederate Avenue? Up
yeah,
there?
Yeah. It intersects Confederate Avenue, the old one.
And it comes around.
And it comes around, and then it goes down here. It gets up on Bushman Hill and gets the 5th New York Monument and
really?
It gets the 18th Pennsylvania. And then it goes down to Ridge Road and it gets all those monuments down there. I mean, Kilpatrick Avenue was some big,
wow,
snaggy looking road.
Never paved it.
Never paved it? No. That's because Kilpatrick's a schmuck and he killed his own men. Just ask Grant and the boys. Huh?
The you guys, how many of you have read my article on the history slab? One, two, three, four. And you found it?
Oh, I've been there, yeah. Four. Measured and everything.
All right.
No evidence of any plumbing attachment or sink, nor was there any accommodation for drainage. If it's a privy. Plus the neatly beveled edges. Where's Mike? The neatly beveled edges gave strong indication that the slab was used for decorative purposes and not a utilitarian stone. I would agree. This mystery slab, which we called it when we first started looking for clues, etc. I started going around asking all my guide friends if they knew what this was, because it impacted where Farnsworth was killed, at least by some accounts. So they all said, yeah, I think it's the First Vermont. Well, a handy measurement would reveal quickly that the First Vermont would not fit on this stone. It's too fat and it's too short. It doesn't work. Okay? So first of all, I knew it wasn't the First Vermont stone. And because I found the dedication ceremony and the First Vermont pictures, I knew it was never moved. It was put where it is. So what is it then? Well, then it got me really intrigued. So I asked a bunch of people, and if you want a copy of my article, I can give it to you. Then one guy said he thought it was where the pile of cannonballs was. Okay, well, it wasn't that, because why in the world would they be up here? This is actually within the Confederate lines, okay? So anyway, I don't think Farnsworth ever came up here. What it turns out to be is the exact same size as the 5th New York Monument up on Bushman Hill. Their Colonel Hammond came here and chose this spot. But he was old, and he didn't remember. And he thought it looked like it. And if you go up here, some of these rocks look like that Argument Rock, like on the backside of Bushman Hill. So he said he thought this was where he was. He thought this was Bushman Hill. So he placed it here. Then,
is there a dedication ceremony for this spot?
There is a dedication ceremony. Yeah, there's a dedication ceremony for this spot, and that's part of my evidence also. He says, they call this at the base of Big Round Top. Okay, this is the base of Big Round Top. He says, here at the base of Big Round Top, well, they wouldn't have said that in a dedication speech if he was up on Bushman Hill, if they were dedicating it up there. So then a couple of guys from the regiment came out, and they say that absolutely General Hammond's position is wrong. And then I find in the newspaper, it says that after they all established the lines of battle, that the beautiful monument of the 5th New York, which now stands near the base of Big Round Top, is not only fully half a mile from where the regiment was stationed, but it was inside the main Confederate line, occupied them during the entire battle. It is said, however, that this monument will be removed to its proper place as soon as the Battlefield Memorial Association opens the avenue along the line of battle on the ridge west of Plum Run, which is Kilpatrick Avenue, which goes up there. Okay? Finally, the last piece of evidence, I was still not quite satisfied, because the picture in New York at Gettysburg is of it on Bushman Hill. And that's in 1900, so I think they probably wrote the text or whatever, moved the monument in the late 1880s, and then by 1890 had a new picture of it and published it in 1900. Also, the GBMA minutes of the Gettysburg Battlefield Memorial Association say that the 5th New York Cavalry was told to move their monument to the right place. So they just left the base. They made a new one exactly like it. And for those of you who measured it also will agree, it's exactly the same measurements. So the 5th New York Monument, which is the one up on Bushman Hill, used to sit right here. See the base?
Yep.
So that's what this is. It impacts in no way the place where Farnsworth was killed. Okay?
How'd you find this in the first place?
It's been known to the guides for a long time that it was here, and it was always speculated about, and I didn't care anything about it until Eric Wittenberg said it was the location of the First Vermont Monument. Mm-hmm. Then I needed to know, because he says because the First Vermont was up here, you see, he does the same thing Gary Cross does.
This
Gary
the
takes
spot.
The current monument and goes 150 yards west, which he thinks is south. And then Wittenberg takes the this monument and goes 150 yards west, which he thinks is south. So now that we have figured out, first of all, which way south is, and that this was never the monument, and that that was never intended as the brigade site, but always as a regimental site, and that the brigade site was down the hill, Tipton tells us that, Oates tells us that, and it's also obvious to see that the first Vermont monument never would have been placed on a brigade site in the 1880s if later in the 1890s they're still planning on putting up that monument.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you have to go down the hill and then you have to get a compass and go south. And if you go south 150 yards from the Wells Monument, you're standing right on the spot where Oates tells us six times that's where it was. You're on the slope of Bushman Hill. You're very close to the gun line, which Farnsworth would have been trying to get back to after the charge. You're also in a rocky, you know, very close to the rocky declivity at the edge of Plum Run, which is where the surgeon said he found his body. It was stripped, so it could have been moved a little bit. It's very close to there. Also, you're close to where the horse fell, which supposedly fell right after the first stone wall, which I think is right back there. So it all starts to come together, and I think Oates is pretty adamant about that spot, as he describes it six or eight times. You know, these are all in his account. Let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Where are all the accounts? I mean, obviously the latest one is his book, right? But
the latest account, well, you have the first one is 1868, a letter to E.P. Alexander. It's in the Southern Historical Society papers, where he says it's within my observation. Then in 1876, it's a letter to John Batchelder, which he says, we came down rear rank in front, passing through a little skirt of timber and rising the hill. Riley could not see, and Farnsworth and his then little squadron passed between Riley and myself. Still, he thinks Riley's on Bushman Hill. I received a full discharge of canister from Riley's guns. It could have been Elder's gun, because Elder could see the infantry coming toward him. And this caused me to halt, which Farnsworth saw, pistol in hand, blah, 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 the suicide story. That's 1878, Southern Historical Society papers. In that, Oates writes, I was ordered to go with my regiment to protect the battery. Why is he going to protect the battery if they're not charging it, right? I did not take time to countermarch, but moved rapidly, rear in front, throwing out a few skirmishers as I advanced. When ascending the hill at the edge of the woods, okay, a portion of the cavalry came in between me and the battery. And then, that's 1878. Then in 1888, letter of Oates to, in the Batchelder papers, Oates to Batchelder, and just as I was rising the hill, approaching the little copse of woods, a squadron of cavalry came in between me and the battery. Same story. And then in 1897, the next day, I was sent across the run to defend Riley's battery against the charge, Farnsworth cavalry, when my skirmishers killed that general. Well, did they kill him or did he commit suicide? Well, that's the first one. Okay, and then in 1905, he says, we passed through an open space and crossed Plum Run. Puts us over there, the same little muddy stream I described in detailing our first advance. And as we rose the ascent in a copse of woods, some 8 or 10 cavalrymen came in between us and the battery. Blah, blah, woof, woof. He tells us this six times, exactly the spot. And if you go 150 yards from the Wells Monument, you get there.
And Riley, even if he wouldn't fire in canister, I mean, that's too long a range, really, for him to really have been that effective.
And the hill's in the way.
Yeah.
And Oates says the first time the canister fire went above their heads, and he said it sounded like partridges fluttering in the trees or something, just hitting the leaves. That would have been perfect for Elder at close range as Oates goes down toward the run. I don't think in Kathy George's map, you asked me about Kathy George, her map has Oates doing a right wheel and coming in. Well, that's because Parsons' account says it happened there. She has to make it fit. Oates never says anything about a wheel. He says we ran down the hill, rear and front, went over the stream, straight up the hill, because he says at one point that the battery was located on a hill 200 yards in my rear. And so he thinks that where Elder's battery is, you know, that's where he's supposed to go.
I'd be surprised if he'd have gone up there.
So now we've talked about Kilpatrick's reputation, which is one of the controversies, and we've talked a little bit about Farnsworth, but Kilpatrick's reputation, we've talked about the argument and a possible explanation for that. We talked about Parsons' credibility, which doesn't really stand up to the Mott's test, which I call the Mott's test, okay, because his comrades don't agree with him, and his account is suspect for malice or at least, what do you call it, bias.
Mm-hmm.
And then we also talked about, we talked about the argument, we talked about the route of the charge, and we talked about the suicide concept, and we talked about the death site. So, did anybody go away with a different concept of what they started with? You still? Anybody? Did you come with a blank canvas?
Yes.
Have I painted a masterpiece?
I am overwhelmed.
She hasn't been tainted by Parsons.
Well, this is good. Whatever you read, be skeptical about everything. Even my stuff. Pull it out and look at it. I mean, we almost always give footnotes, but in so many cases, especially this new biography of Kilpatrick, you can read the footnote. I mean, most of the accounts, I mean, he's a licentious whoremonger and everything else. Mm. You read the accounts, it's an account written in 1950, 1960, 1980. But where are the guys that were with him that would know? I don't care about some other author's interpretation. And then you get the guys that know, and it turns out that, you know, completely normal guy. Anyway, you can't take their villain away, though.